We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast. Soylent Green is people. I'm your host today, tonight, Russ Hugo, and joining me this morning for him is Kurt North. How are you doing morning?
We're not quite sure where or when we are, which is fantastic. Yes, it's 1:11 in the morning over in the UK here. So yes, I'm feeling wide awake and ready to talk about some Native American isms and subcultures, which should be fantastic.
Thank you for your sacrifice. You've given up the good ghost, as is probably the title of the text in your podcatcher. Today we're going to be talking about A Single Blade of Grass, which is the fifth episode of season two. It originally aired on October 24th in 1997, directed by Rodman Flender, who I don't believe didn't direct any other Millennium episodes. And a lot of his other work we can talk about, which I think may inform the style of the episode. And it was written, the first thing actually ever written by, not just for Millennium, but just ever written by Aaron Mayer and Kay Rendell. And of course, now it comes to the great question. I don't know if you've checked. I'm sure you've checked, but you can pretend that you haven't. What do you think the IMDb rating for this episode is?
I haven't checked, but because of doing quite a few episodes, I think I half remember just from passing it. I think it was around about the late sixes. I'm going to say it was 6.9.
It's practically correct. It's 6.8.
6.8. Yeah, it's just with doing the previous episodes and looking at the episodes in a run. Have you actually looked at where that falls in? Because that seems to me that's probably going to be at least second or third or even bottom of the list, I would have thought.
Yeah, you're right. It's the bottom.
It's the bottom.
It's the lowest of the season.
Right, yeah. Okay. Out of curiosity, what would you place down there then with it? I'm trying to think if there's an episode that I would think is probably worse than it.
Ooh, for the season or just for Millennium in general?
Just their season two.
No, for season two, I would put it, I feel pretty comfortable with it there at the bottom. What about you?
I do think it's probably out of the entire run, it's probably of season two is probably, yeah, it deserves to be bottom. I'm just trying to think of what other episode I would place around that area. Potentially Sense and Anti-Sense, maybe. Would be down there. I would have thought, but yeah, it's an unusual episode, and it's got its good parts, and it's got some interesting elements, but it's not the best in episode, and it's very X-Files light in some ways.
So speaking of all that, what would you, if you had to pick a number from 1 to 10? Because I know this, some people use a weighted scale or even distributed scale. What would you put this episode?
Yeah, I mean, I would normally do a 10, and I'm normally really quite generous with my rankings. I tend to not have a 10 at all, even though my favourite episodes would never attain a 10. And I'm quite, as I say, generous on the bottom end. But I would say this probably would get a 6 for me. I think, as I say, it's an interesting story. It's got some interesting elements, but it does fall flat. And it's kind of a bit out there and doesn't really land what it's trying to do.
All fair points. I probably, because I'm one of them sticklers who likes to have, if possible, a distributed scale on an even curve. So some episodes need to be at the bottom. There needs to be a 1 or a 2 or a 3. But I don't know. It doesn't have to be a 1. It doesn't have to be that harsh. I have got a lot of issues with this episode. I also, you know, I like some of the things it attempts. So I probably would have to get maybe a 2.5. I think,
right.
Also because I think it is the weakest in there. That doesn't mean that it's objectively compared to all TV or anything ever made, right there, but just within the scope of Millennium, that's where I would probably put it.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So from what you're saying there, just the way that you actually grade it would, and if I was going down your grade, and I would probably jump down to a 3 in that kind of sense. But
gotcha.
I would kind of, it's 6 is kind of quite drastic for where I would normally put things. I would normally a decent solid episode go for a 7, and a decent episode would be an 8, and then your nines are kind of like the ones that I find outstanding. So yeah, so mine are really kind of quite tightly knitted together. But yeah, if I was to go kind of your kind of graphic, then it would definitely, I would be right around about a 3, I would have thought.
It's actually helpful with your rating scale because it matches a lot of the IMDb's curve.
Yeah.
Maybe before we get into the episode, just a little brief thought. What's your overall thought of the episode? You mentioned a little bit about some things it does good or not. Maybe expand on that just a little bit. What's your capstone summary?
I think that the things it does kind of not the best is going back to the old trope of 1013 productions with using subcultures and Native Americanisms and blatantly using Red Crow Westman for the episode to try and bring in the X-Files audience, and I think it's kind of like an X-Files light in some ways. Having said that, I do appreciate the aspect of the Lost Tribe idea, that they've got this tribe that's split out between 5 or 6 different tribes, and it's a hidden tribe within that. So I like that idea, and I like that story element. And I also like something that Millennium does quite a lot on, which is people's own personal apocalypse rather than the apocalypse of, you know, the year 2000 or whatever that apocalypse may be. This might be just a number of different series of events leading up to a larger one. So I also think that some of the guest stars, especially Dr. Michaels, is a good guest star on there as well. So yeah, I think it's desperate. It's the elements that are actually quite good, but overall they don't fit together well.
Yeah, well said. Good points, and I look forward to expanding them further. And it'll be good to flesh it out. I had a very difficult time with a lot of the elements in it, and I do appreciate the creativity of the Lost Tribe, regardless of the plausibility in any of that. It's, you know, it's a fun thing to think about, and I think that's a good addition to the script. But I do have an issue with there's a absence of characterization. There are so many chances that I think you could feel some degree of empathy for the plight of Joe and the other tribal members there and about what they're feeling and a little bit of that. And I don't feel that there was any connection expressed. And two, there's also no real ethics here. And maybe because I'm a United States citizen and I live in an area where there's a lot of presence of indigenous nations and the fact of colonialism and genocide and the ongoing issues that are happening there aren't even touched on.
Yeah.
There's this abstract apocalypse, like we want our land back, but there none of that trauma, all of this stuff that I think Millennium can normally mine so well, and nothing. It's barely even brushed up against. And we'll get into it a little bit later, but after I made my notes, I went and I read Darren's review of it on the movie blog, and he makes some good points that I think they were trying to go in some directions, and maybe some of them were actually pretty clever and nice, and then some maybe a little flat-footed. But we can get into that, yeah. And I don't mean to be delaying our cold open. So now we're going to get to the credit sequence and on to the main episode. Maybe we'll just start with how the scene's set up, and then wherever we go, we go. We don't necessarily have to do a complete follow-through of the script. But one thing that's unique about the episode is that there is no opening text. There's no intro quote.
Yeah.
And instead, we get narration by Floyd Red Crow Westerman that you mentioned earlier of X-Files fame. And what are your thoughts about the general opening, the scene, and the way how it transitions out from the ceremony to the hotel?
You mentioned there at the beginning that we don't get your opening title card of where they are, how they are. And obviously, that's done by design because of its location and the way that we track out of the hotel. So having Red Crow doing his overdub, his monologue, instantly kind of put me a little bit off. I think what's the first line is something like, "Don't tell the white man," which is the first line, which instantly puts you on the back foot of like, okay, then what's going to happen here? And we see this ritual, which, as I say, with the using that instantly with the Mark Snow music put me a bit on edge. But knowing, being a 1013 fan, I was kind of, okay, are we going down here? But I did really enjoy the pull-out and the tracking scene. And you mentioned Darren Mooney. I think he relates that to The Shining in some ways, and I can see where he was coming from with that. That I like the way that the camera tracks out into the hotel, and then as it goes out the hotel, there's a cut scene where I think it's a car or something goes past, and or a man goes past, and then we find out we're actually in New York. So if we just take the subculture thing out from it for the time being, I think that it really works to kind of keep you on edge, and it's a juxtaposition of what your expectations are going forward, because you're thinking this must be in Native America or wherever it is, and we're actually in downtown New York. So I think that the actual cold open does really well to throw you off guard, and you're not quite sure where it's going to go from there.
I agree. You know, one thing that Darren noted in his review that I thought was really a well-made observation is the idea that they're in the basement, kind of representing buried history, and then this modern architecture of Western civilization is built on top of that. And so it's a sort of a way of mirroring the archaeological dig and the remnants of colonialism and all the rest.
In Blade Runner, where they had the rich people living on the top levels, and when you get down to the basement, that's where all of the people who were poor were working. And I think it's got that aspect to it as well. That, you know, as I say, it's a subculture, it's an underbelly of New York, and it's almost like, as you say, keeping it buried or keeping it hidden. And it's an interesting comment that they're making, but I don't think they really push that any more than what they could have done.
Unfortunately, but the idea, whether it was mostly on the director's end or whatever, I have to say it's one of the highlights of the episode. On This Is Who We Are, they noted that the narration actually came from something called the Messiah Letter, written by, and don't have a translation of how to pronounce it, but I'm just going to go by the English translation of Uwavoka, with English name of Jack Wilson, was a Paiute religious leader and part of the Ghost Dance movement. So in there's references of the dead are still alive again, and don't know when they will be here, maybe this fall or in this spring. When the time comes, there'll be no more sickness and everyone will be young again. So they're trying to play with that idea of resurrection, and then of course the Western religious apocalypse with the reference to Jesus. So it's an interesting idea. I wish that they could have included where that was from, because when you watch it, I didn't know if this was taken from a resource like it was, or if it was written by Mayer and Rendall or what. All we know is to hear the voice. And it's very purplish prose to some degree that it seems like Carter could have wrote this, perhaps. So
I didn't realize it was off something, so that's interesting. And especially because later in the episode when they start talking about the ghost dance and things, so they've obviously done some research into that aspect, which is a good thing in some ways, because at least that they are researching into the actual culture rather than just putting on screen what they think is best, really.
There are some areas where they missed the boat potentially, but yeah, they did make an effort, and that's good. I think at the beginning, and it's uncredited, and I couldn't find any proof of this, but it looks like Darren Burroughs is one of the men in the opening ceremony who played Ed Chigliak in Northern Exposure. I could be wrong, but right. I'm just guessing, being that he was probably around the Northwest from around that time with Northern Exposure, and maybe you could just bring him up for the day to Vancouver, but I don't know. I don't know if you saw him or aware of him or
not too much. No, okay. It's not something that I've picked up on.
Maybe somebody, if they're listening, if they have any quote unquote proof of that and can confirm it on the Facebook group, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
So okay. We then cut over to Dr. Michaels, an archaeologist, is at a dig in the middle of downtown New York, surrounded by skyscrapers or at least tall apartment buildings, and excavating what is an old indigenous. We learn some degree there's a burial there, and they're having a debate with the foreman or engineer who wants to build the building. And what are your thoughts about this initial confrontation and the setup of this conflict?
I think it's a bit too on the nose, personally. I think the character of Powell, I think it's Powell who's the guy in the suit. Overall, I mean, I'm just not just talking this scene, but his portrayal really grates on me. I just think it's too one-dimensional and there isn't anything drawn with it. It's too on the nose. It doesn't really work in that aspect. But Dr. Michaels, I thought she was a nice counterpoint to Frank. But in this particular scene, you know, we're finding out who she is and what she's doing there. And this kind of the reveal that we've got Daniel, who has died and has been placed in there along with the other burial, was quite well done, actually. I thought the clash between Dr. Michaels and Powell was a bit too much and too, you know, as I say, on the nose. I thought that it did enough to give us an idea, a sense of place and what we were really kind of looking into going forward. So yes, I thought it's a mixed bag, I think.
Yeah, I will totally agree about Powell, especially in a later scene, which I'm sure we'll get to. It really is a difficult watch. I'll try not to nitpick things too much, but the conflict that's happening here is, it's not just their dialogue that's forced. You have a bunch of engineers and you know, foremen and workers standing around the outside. There's no way in any world that anyone's living in, anybody would pay these people to show up and just like, oh, at any moment, these people are going to finish their dig. Mm. Or the idea that they just started the dig and the people are just hanging out for the day because too much had already been set up and excavated. So I think it was just there to give an excuse to have the workers, the natives there, as well as, I don't know, just to provide a little bit more tension. But it creates an air of disbelievability and, I guess, over eggs the pudding, as they say. Like you said, it's too on the nose, and that visualization makes it even more extreme.
Actually, just before the actual scene, some of the stock shots of New York does quite well to put it into that place. But you are right with them all standing around, and they are pretty much standing on their marks as well. It felt like it was forced that way, that, you know, the directors or whoever's told them, you stand there, you stand there, you stand there. And it just felt very forced that you had this wall of people looking on at this excavation site, of them having this argument, which wouldn't be an argument in the first place. They wouldn't be having this argument at the scene. or you just don't really believe and kind of have any kind of connection to that scene as such. And I do think it's, as you say, it forces that believability, I think, definitely.
And the next one, this is a minor one, but just for the rhythm, I do like the staging and I like the idea, but when they're down there and she's excavating the older body, the other archaeologist, you know, says, Dr. Michaels, come look at this. And then they see it and it's a mask and it's a new mask, but she lifts it off as if there's a face underneath, but not enough has been excavated, or at least hasn't shown, that you would know that there's a body there, and she's already acting scared, like as if there's a body there.
Yeah.
And then they also already know it's a murder just by looking at the face, even though there's no trauma or anything to go by. We don't have any of this information. They're not giving it. Just a lot of assumptions are being made. Minor point, but it took me out of the story a little bit too.
Yeah, I don't think it took me out of the story as much with the reveal of him underneath there. But then I suppose we've seen him in the cold open. So I think that that's probably probably a main thing, really.
It's minor. It's a reinforcement of something when I kept watching it, that the director, it seems, didn't have a lot of experience with procedurals and some details like this, and getting the rhythm of moving a procedural along are missed. And I think it could just be a lack of familiarity with the genre and also with horror in general. Although they had done, looks like, some Tales from the Crypt in the past, I think there's a very different aesthetic with Millennium that you said there's an X-Files feel. And I guess maybe cut to the chase now is looking at, seems like the director did a lot of work on things like Dawson's Creek or Party of Five. And I could feel a lot of those, the softer 90s cuts and framing and the rest. And it's even a little softer edged than a lot of X-Files episodes. That's the one thing I was kind of shocked by, is it's a really unthreatening, gentle, and not just in the writing, but I think the presentation. It's almost PG or even softer in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think we'll probably touch on this one a little bit later on with some elements that I thought actually was even though it's quite horrific, the idea, the actual delivery of this of the scene, which we'll pick up later on, is a bit is, as you say, softened down, and it doesn't. It's kind of bland in some ways. I think that it does suffer for that, definitely.
And then in the scene, you've got Chekhov's elephants that brought up when Frank comes in. He's like, just happened to be following behind a circus. And so, yeah, it's cute. It was cute.
Yeah, yeah. We've got truckloads of elephants. We've got a show on down the road. That's not going to play into anything with Chekhov at all, is it? So, yeah, it's a nice little element, but it's maybe too signposted, I think, a little bit. But we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah, we shall. Another thing is, this episode comes after Beware the Dog and the rest, but here it's very emphatic that Frank is psychic at this point. The old season one ambiguity is gone. And already from the beginning, he knows that the person was murdered. He knows they were murdered nearby without seeing any of the details. And this gets reinforced throughout the episode. And what are your thoughts about this shift in the Millennium mythology?
Personally, some aspects of it I really like. You mentioned Beware of the Dog there. He did say, the old man in Beware of the Dog did say that Frank's visions were going to come back. I think in Beware of the Dog, his personal issues that had him following from the events of the beginning and the end with the murder of the Polaroid stalker, all of that aspect was his gift, was giving him personal flashes rather than anything to do with the case. But the old man does say to Frank, you know, come back, it'll be different. And here we get a continuation of that thread. The only issue that I've got is the CGI is absolutely horrific. It becomes more esoteric. I think it was Wong that said that it needed to be, they wanted it to be a bit more like he needs to decipher what's being seen. And during this episode, we are seeing elements of, you know, the fact that you've got all this symbology of the crows flying in, you've got the coyote, which is a great little acting piece from Lance Henriksen in that scene, actually. But you've got all these aspects of kind of things being deciphered. And I actually wondered as well, I don't know what you think about this. This is maybe a good question to ask you in retort to what you've just asked me there. That I personally think that they didn't mine that as much as that what I would have personally have liked. I would like to have seen Frank over the course of episodes going forward to kind of struggle more with it and to find more issues, or, you know, it doesn't really seem affected by it. It's like, oh, well, it's changed now. It's about crows. It's about coyotes. I need to decipher it. And that's it. We do get nothing after this episode about the visions at all. So personally, for me, I think that I quite like the idea of this psychic connection that's going on to another plane to be able to decipher stuff if it's used sparingly and done well. And I think they use it quite a bit in, or a few times on, The Hand of St. Sebastian as well. But other than that, I know that Morgan and Wong were really trying to keep away from that as much as possible. But what would you say to that? What would you say about the fact that they didn't really mind the effect that that would have on Frank, that these psychic visions that he's having, right? It's more like, we'll solve this case and move on.
Yeah, it's a good question. I have just a personal preference to get out of the gate that I preferred the season one ambiguity and the non-supernatural interpretation for storytelling reasons. And I think it just works for the character a little bit better. I like then to be able to divide the three seasons as their own skewed worldview. And so season two, it's the supernatural world. That's fine. I can buy into that. But I'm with you there. I think you put it right on the money that the reaction we get from Frank, we don't get to really deal with it. And it's not consistently enough used. Even this episode, he seems pretty nonchalant when he's talking to Dr. Michaels about, you know, I've been into that plane and I can go there and I can get my visions or get the visions and I can tap into it. And, you know, you're going to deal with continuity and the rest that can create a lot of problems for other episodes down the road on why he's not making steps that he should. If he's seen the things that were seen and or the trauma that would be introduced in the rest, it's not a huge misstep. It doesn't ruin the season for me, and it doesn't ruin the episode, but it does weaken the humanity. And one reason I prefer season one is there's a lot more emotional and humane resonance to it. Season two has got some good drama and character development, and there is some nice humanity beats, but sometimes it shifts a little bit more into that X-Files vein where it's more about the symbology and the mythology in the sense of the constructing of the overall plot than some of those feelings and emotions. And it would have been nice, now that you raise it up, that this could have been added into it. And it also, I guess it would have driven him, like the previous visions were, he says, a gift and a curse, and we deal with the curse aspect. And in season two, I think it would have been a nice excuse to be able to explain some of his behavior. And not to jump ahead too far, but I recently rewatched all the way through season two, you know, for in preparation for listening through the podcast, and getting to the end and Frank's treatment of Catherine is not explained and not dealt with at all. It's very unfortunate. And there should be a lot of guilt. There should be a lot of shame. And there isn't. And the script doesn't hold him accountable. And this would have been a nice way to help explain why he behaved the way he did, especially looking at the final episode.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things, because you talk about season one, and I think you've said on the podcast that it's his empathy over the course of season one. The gift was kind of his empathy coming through there and being able to feel the emotions that he needs to feel. If they'd build that into Frank with him trying to understand his gift a bit more, I know we've got things like The Curse of Frank Black and Midnight of the Century coming up and things that skirt around it, but they don't really directly talk about the gift as such. It's more about Jordan and his fears for her, which I appreciate, you know, the fact that Jordan is a big part of his life and in season two revolves around her quite a lot. And as you say, the Catherine element, it would have been nice to have that extra bit of his empathy coming through from trying to work out where he lies with his gift and why it's happening to him and what's happened, and it, we don't really get that satisfactorily. We just kind of brush it off and then we move into the mythos and the actual secular stuff with owls and roosters. So yeah, so and I know that there's been an argument that if it's a psychic thing, then that's it's an easy for writers, it's quite easy, we'll just do that, a psychic, we can get from A to B to C, which I appreciate. But I think if they did think about it a bit more with this plane idea, with this symbology idea in a bit more detail, it could have been quite nice for him to physically decipher it, because he wouldn't necessarily need to know, I need to go to A, B, and C. He's saying, I can see C, but I don't understand what A and B are. And we don't really get that with the gift.
It's a great point. I appreciate you bringing that up. I think in Luminary, they could have connected that a little bit better.
Yeah.
There is a line kind of going in there with how he's dealing with the visions. And it would have been nice, especially with Catherine's reading of the book and Mount Ventoux, that he's sort of reaching some new personal renaissance.
Yeah.
It comes across more of a way of him coming to grips with his relationship with the group and his relationship with Catherine, which is great. But there is all of that dream logic and symbology, and it would have been nice to connect it. It's also difficult for me when I was watching it through and you see something like the Mikado, where they're having their cake and eat it too, and going back to a season one style interpretation. And it's fine. It's fine. But it's something fun to explore.
I do like the Mikado from that aspect, though, that you've got, you know, when he's literally, I mean, I know we're not talking about that, but he can't use his gift because he can't get it through the TV screen or the monitors. I do like that. I do like that little touch there. That's the sort of thing I think I'm trying to get to, really, is making use of it as part of a story element, the fact he can't use it. And, you know, that was probably written on purpose to make sure that he couldn't use that gift. But I think they could have done more with it along those lines.
Exactly. If you can get this nice rule set up that's clear to the viewer. Millennium has never been
it's got
great
no rules
about that. But it would be nice to have that set up about, okay, we're going to deal with symbology. And the one thing that I think was so refreshing about the Mikado in season two is because it was very explicit in its rules. And not that everything in season two had to be that way or anything else, but it is a nice break from some of the more ethereal plot structures where you don't know where you're going to go. Transitioning from that, as opposed to just going scene by scene, but kind of talking about the scenes that are relevant, is to kind of talk about, you brought up the subject, and I'd like to explore a little bit more with you, the representation of Native American or Indigenous American peoples, cultures, histories, symbologies. Maybe we can think about, to start off with, is I think it's a bit on the line of maybe a little too convenient, but the way that it's delivered, I think it generally works. The fact that you have this group of people who are related to this space, allegedly, working on a construction site where they happen to find the things. So, A, we can make an assumption that they knew that they would find the artifacts there, and so they purposely got themselves onto the job site, or if it's just convenient writing. But overall, I think it helps, and I think the representation of them, similar to, I think, X-Files did pretty well, like the paperclip and the blessing way, where they're showing, in that case, Navajo or Dene people living what would be considered modern lives. And not necessarily that we have to do that, but in the 90s when everything was falling back on very heavy mysticism and noble savages and connecting to nature and be able to show a humanity through that angle. I think it worked pretty good in the X-Files in that case, like motorbikes and the rest and the way people are interacting while still holding on to their culture. I think the attempt that's being made here works pretty well. What are your thoughts? That's a lot of jumble I just gave you.
It's fine. I think I always struggle with this type of talking about something that I'm not too au fait with in general, but I think you hit the nail on the head with paperclip and the best blessing way is that what I tend to see when watching things like this is that if it's too one-dimensional, if it's just about the ritual and they're using it, because I don't know, you know, I can even say this about Christianity, that I'm not a religious person and I don't know, you know, that one of the lines is like, would you know if a Jewish person goes into a Catholic church, would you know what they were doing, and that's kind of where I'm coming from, that I struggle a little bit with understanding where the line should be drawn. But the one big thing that I definitely come back to every time is exactly what you've just said there, that in a modern world, in a multicultural society, that there is people who have their own beliefs, there is people who will have their own rituals, there'll be people who are Jewish or Catholic or Navajo or wherever it may be, that will lead a normal, and I don't mean that by any means, I don't mean that detrimentally, but just a normal day-to-day life with whatever they do, with their own beliefs, and they have tacked on their actual beliefs and things that they do outside, say, of a normal working life. The issue comes for me with TV shows is when they seem to zone in on one particular element and that they want to talk about, and they don't really pull out what the rest of their life would be. And I think you said that in this one, that at least they are putting their culture into an area where they would be working, where they would be socializing in the bar and their conversations. But when it comes to the ritual side of things, I wouldn't like to comment too much just purely because I'm not too sure. But I think it's definitely done a lot better than it has been in certain other episodes of the show. Things like El Mundo Gira from The X-Files, for example, where they literally turn a culture into two monsters not being seen by the roadside. I think that there's elements there that I wasn't happy about. But that's kind of where I see, and I definitely think that they've made an attempt to not do that. And as I mentioned before, the fact that it's a hidden tribe and all tribes are represented on that wall, so it's not especially directed at anyone in particular. It's more of a theme than an actual mixture of themes, rather than just being a direct point at a particular area or culture.
Yeah, the multi-tribe angle works well for some of the scenes and some of the plot stuff. Where it gets more problematic for me is what the camera does. Of course, the score, which you mentioned already, it's not just classic foreign people woo-woo horn sound, but it's also got the, you know, some generic indigenous, Native indigenous American chanting and hollering and things like this.
And the kind of bongo things and things like that as well. So a bit pointed, isn't it?
And the fact that it's done in a way that's threatening. It's done in an environment trying to create some degree of fear. There's that scene in the museum where there's a zoom in of a scary totem pole.
Yeah.
And this overemphasis of mysticism. I want to set that one thing aside about the multiple tribes idea and agree with you 100% that I think that's a very good way of getting around some of these issues. But in that aspect, I think that necessitates some ethical recognition of what brought these people to this state. and what they've gone through to be here, and the fact that we get no, I said earlier, emotional connection, we get no personality. I don't get any characterization from any of the people belonging to that group. Joe, the actor who plays him, I put down
Michael Gray eyes.
Yeah, Michael Gray eyes. I think he does a fabulous job. He does a great job with what he's given.
Yeah.
But this episode tries to make that comment about later, jumping ahead, there's an argument between Dr. Michaels and Powell. And he says, you're no better than I am because you're digging up these things and selling them to a journal. And there's that whole angle.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, because I think I was thinking this actually when I watched it before, that exact scene is he's not having any input into that conversation whatsoever. And it's something that would affect him deeply, and we don't get any element of that from him. The only, as you were saying about its depth, the only thing that we get is that he goes into a bar and plays a game, and that isn't characterization. That's just putting him into a place of leisure, and we need more than that. And I think, as you say, if that Powell and Michael scene had included Joe in there, at least we'd get more characterization from him.
Exactly. And the fact that we're talking about this idea that Michael's as a powerful white outsider is using indigenous culture for their career and trying to problematize that, yet you're writing a script where the powerful white academic gets all of the lines talking about the indigenous culture, and the people that this is all about don't get to say or express anything. Except for maybe that one line which you mentioned about the Catholic walked into a synagogue.
Yeah,
they would at least recognize it's a religion. I think that line there is an excellent point I'm going to give to the episode's credit. But the fact that it's a little hypocritical for them to have that scene in an episode that doesn't give a voice to – I mentioned that for the fourth time and I probably won't drop it. I'm probably going to keep repeating myself until you kick me off the podcast. But you're going to deal with something that in the United States – and this is actually a worldwide issue of colonialism and genocide and the rest. But here in the U.S., we have not wrestled with it to the degree that we – and you're going to create something about this that is – the causes of this predicament are complex, horrifying, violent, morally challenging, and all the rest. And we're not even going to give them an address. And then we're not even going to give you an emotional connection. The only time I think you feel anything, or I did when I watched the episode, is the very end.
Yeah.
When you see the disappointment in the look of the people, but it's almost more of like pity rather than sympathy. And it makes me feel a little gross.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that you're right with the disappointment thing, that, when he's looking across the road and you see his demeanor, we needed more. That's the one big thing in the whole episode that I think that the characterization on pretty much everyone, apart from maybe Michaels and Frank, it hasn't been thought out well enough. And I think for the episode to have worked and worked better, you would have given Joe more things to do and more things to say and have an opinion on things, because that would be the way into the story and to make it a human story rather than just being a plot device of these hidden tribes. I think that's definitely something that's been a big miss in the episode, really.
Also, going back to you were talking about the bar and playing a game, and I missed this, but Darren Mooney brought this up in his review, and I thought this was really well observed, that the group there, they are portrayed gambling. And also later with the scene, like talismans, I'm not sure what we would call those that they're casting to read for the future, that there's a sort of a mimicry of the two and some of the things they talk about, being able to control their fate with gambling. And Darren points out about the problem when it comes to the representation in the United States, especially in the 90s, and it's ongoing, but of Native Americans as greedy gambling, whether they're gambling addicts initially, and then now they're greedy gambling empires, and this is very much associated with their culture. And I think it had to have been somewhat intentional, or at least it had to be in their subconscious. And again, that's a very big ethical misstep on a part of the writers, in my opinion, to not problematize that at all, to not do anything with it or look at it other than simply say, oh, it's them trying to control the apocalypse and control their fate. And I'll give that, okay, that's nice. That's nice in the sense they're trying to get themselves some sort of economic autonomy, but you got to at least go that far for the viewer in the context that we're talking about. And I guess a lot of my complaints are probably going to be a little bit different because of where I live and where I grew up than you in the UK. I'm curious to see what you picked up on based on your knowledge and awareness.
Yeah, I didn't pick it up on that. I mean, the gambling thing didn't really come across like that to me at all. And I read the same review from Darren, you know, 6 months ago, whenever it was I last did my rewatch. But yeah, it's not something that I would have picked up. I think the more common things from that kind of element would be some of the stereotypical Jewish things that people would put into TV shows more than anything else. But the Native Americanism stuff is not something that I'm too au fait with. And like I said before, it's something that I couldn't really comment on without that knowledge. But it is something to bear in mind. Now that I know, I think they could have done something better with it and at least done something with the script. I mean, I know it's only a 45-minute episode, but you didn't necessarily need that scene in there if you weren't going to go full on with it, because it has elements of, you know, controlling your fate and what have you, but then we've got the things like the prayer stick later on, which would sort of have that idea and process behind it. So I wouldn't necessarily think that you would need that, but if they are making some sort of comments on that, then that is something that they needed to flesh out a bit more.
Another issue I had is that they're trying to play a little fast and loose with symbology and culture and history, and they're trying to portray things as being real that are maybe real and other things that are not real as being real. Or if we're talking about something like we did earlier with El Mundo Gira, you have a marginalized population, but a lot of what's known about that population is what we could say culturally public domain. It's pretty much out in the open. With indigenous cultures, there is a history of theft and appropriation that is very troubling. And you have issues of genocide, and then you have the U.S. government enacting policies to prevent children from learning their language. We take their kids, we take them to a boarding school, and if they speak the language or connect with their culture, we beat them. And then when they get to a certain age, we'll send them back, and there's a major disconnect with the family. We're going to break up groups, and we're going to put pressure about destroying the cultures. And the religious aspects, the ceremonial aspects of them, the symbologies, the language, all of these things have a power and a weight that a lot of the other subcultures that are represented on television like 1013.
Yeah.
There's a sensitivity that I think needs to be played, and in this episode, it's a little troubling. Some of the comments, especially this comes out with in the 90s, there was a big craze of Native American mysticism, and the Book of the Hopi is an example that came out, and there was a lot of stuff that Western culture took from that. And there's some mentions that Dr. Michael states, like, oh, the Hopi predicted the railroad. A, what's the reference for that? How true is that? Where did they get that? And the Hopi Nation, from my understanding, was very unhappy with the fact that somebody came in and recorded some of these tales and symbols and cultural aspects and then published it out for the rest of the world. It doesn't belong there. There are certain things that only belong within the nation itself. There are certain things that only belong within the ceremonial space of like a longhouse. And for this episode to kind of take symbology and ideas of like prayer stick and I'm just going to throw it all mishmash, hodgepodge. I'm going to take all these actors and have them put face paint on that may or may not. And the fact that some of them do map and pattern with actual history and culture. And I don't mean to look at it from a lens of 2019 and to look back, but this goes back to where it feels a little exploitative because we're not giving that voice. We're not giving the culture that's being represented anything in the episode. And then the fact that it's also they're the villains to some degree. Yes, they're doing it for this reason, but they're still poisoning people and killing people.
You're talking about the Hopi and the railroad. They try. I mean, it's the same with the Jewish and the Catholics, and they also mention Nostradamus as well.
Yeah.
I think there is a conscious effort, and as you say, with 90s TV compared to looking at what we're in 2019 now and how things have moved on. And it seems absolutely natural for us to think about coaches in certain ways in 2019 compared to what it would have been like in the 90s. But there does seem to be some sort of conscious effort, but it doesn't... I mean, you mentioned like the use of mysticism and the using the fear of that, and it doesn't really... I mean, and another theme, which is one of the ones that I was going to mention, actually, and I don't know if we've got round to that, but the hanging of the guy, of Daniel, horizontally was softened out for me. I think that, you know, if that had been in season one, it would have been a lot darker. But then you've got all of the things on the walls, and it was kind of, as you say, it was mismatch of everything you could possibly throw at. And I'm not quite sure what the message was there, whether or not there was a message, whether it was these indigenous people are just the same as somebody who predicts like Nostradamus does, or the same as Catholics are, the same that Jewish are. There does seem to be that potential effort to do that. I just don't think that they managed to stick the landing with it, and it falls flat, but not in the same way as some of the old 10-13 productions do. But it still has that element of where were they going with it, and is it a bit too close to everything? I mean, some of the things you were saying there, they're obviously horrific, that, you know, that any minority person has to go through stuff like that is horrific. And to make something like a culture with the 10-13 production and to highlight that, or even potentially make that worse in the minds of the American people, is something that is quite scary, especially looking back at it from a 2019 lens, really.
Yeah, continuing with what you're saying, there is this issue of we're trying to provide a representation of truth. We're going to try to show some authentic indigenous things, and we're going to mention something about the people that lived in this area, like we have an Iroquois longhouse, and you think, oh, this is pretty believable, except that the problem is that the Iroquois, as far as I can tell, never would probably have had a longhouse in New York City. That would have been the Lenape. And then there's comments like this where the symbol represents – this is a side note, but I do want to bring it up because it happens twice. I thought it was funny. The symbol represents communication with the spirit world. And then Frank states, an apocrypha?
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah. And that's not what an apocrypha is. And then Dr. Michaels also calls Revelations an apocrypha.
Yes.
And again, that's used two different ways, and it's done incorrectly. And for a show that's about – these sorts of things, I thought that was a bit amusing, but that was a small side note. My other thing was trying to get to some of these comments and notes I made here is Dr. Michael says, these people believe and still believe in another plane of existence. And then later, people actually died by the heart squeeze. A Seneca myth described that. So the character says that they actually died by heart squeeze, and then the next sentence states that it's from a myth. And you're also talking about these people. Who are these people? What are we talking about here? That's a very dangerous quote, not just from a 2019 lens. And the fact that this episode already tried to break up and show Native Americans are not a homogenous group, that we have many different nations and tribes and all of the rest, then these kinds of quotes. Native people appear to have access to an elevated plane, but she can't get there no matter how hard she tries. So this idea that Native people are genetically or what predisposed to some sort of magical ability, these tropes were already problematic by the late 90s.
Yeah, I did pick up on that, actually, the way that they were saying that I can't get there. And I was like, well, why are we? I mean, obviously, it's a link in to get Frank, because obviously Frank's getting to that plane. But I did think it was a bit off. The apocrypha thing I definitely picked up on, because the two times I watched it recently, it kind of went, well, but it's one of those things where if you're not making notes, you'll pick up on it and then you forget about it 5 seconds later. And the use of these people is very telling of the script writing for that, because I mean, I know we're talking about through 90s, that's a directed comment, you know, at that a subsection of New York, and that shouldn't be pointed that way. And it's especially the way it's emphasized as well. It's definitely a bit worrying in many senses.
Yeah, and to continue, the issue is that, again, they're showing things that are semi-real to an audience that's probably not going to be exposed to anything else. So I think there's a greater responsibility to either make it completely cartoonish Like, just make this only about a made-up tribe. Why are we bringing up Iroquois and the Hopi and Cree and all of these things and actually taking elements from those cultures when we could simply just say all of these are from a lost tribe? Yeah. And then you don't have to worry about it. But she brings up, oh, this is an Indian prayer stick, and the top and bottom represent heaven and hell. What indigenous culture pre-contact had a concept of heaven and hell?
Yeah.
And why are we trying to – we're trying to introduce a unique culture that is outside of the Western Christian context of millennium, and now you're trying to make this analogy here that doesn't need to be there. And in my, you know, 30 minutes of Googling – could not find anything to support this, both in prayer sticks looking like that and then B, this representation from the nation where the prayer stick was allegedly located at. It's that sort of stuff where it's reinforcing these attitudes that the New Age movement, I think Darren talked about this too in the 90s, and how, and it's still ongoing, how exploitative. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not just this ethical issue of, oh, it's not nice or it doesn't feel bad, is that this has real world consequences. This has real world consequences on policy, on poverty, on cultural health, and all of these things and these views. And so if you're going to play in this pond, and that's what makes me nervous about having this podcast and what I'm saying, yeah, but I'm not broadcasting in the 90s to millions of people, it is exploitative, I think.
A question I've got for you then on this whole aspect is, millennium is viewed through the biblical end of the world apocalypse. Why do an episode like this when we're trying to view, when we've definitely got a lens of a Western society rather than than this society. Having this episode here is already going to give you problems, and you haven't got anybody on the writing staff that are linked to it. You haven't got all these desperate elements. The X-Files has done a few which haven't landed very well. Why would they go down this route is kind of what I'm asking, really. Why do you think that they decided to go down this kind of route? Because it seems to be that their apocalypse would be that the white men would be overcome, that all of the atrocities that we've put on them with everything you've said just over the past 15 minutes or so there, the wheels are going, everything's going to be flipped over come at the end from there, at the end of their apocalypse, their cycle of life, if you will. It's almost like the guilt of the white man, effectively. So why do you think that they kind of went down that route in the first place?
I'll have my reasonable response to that, and then I'll end it with a conspiratorial response.
Okay.
Maybe this isn't reasonable, but the more reasonable response would be there is the idea of millennium representing multiple apocalypses. And in the first season especially, it's a lot of personal apocalypses or societal or familial or community, things like that. And this is maybe a way that they were expecting to go when it came to season two. They weren't sure all the different directions they were going to go. There are all these different apocalypses, and they're not just all white, traditional Western. So my thought is, I think it's just trying to broaden the palette, and I think the idea there is admirable. And this kind of goes to the more conspiratorial angle. Is my hunch is that they watched Peter Weir's The Last Wave and thought, let's do that.
Right, yeah.
It's because it's the premise. I think that movie does it a little bit better, but it's just the idea of an Aboriginal apocalypse in Australia versus an Indigenous or Aboriginal in North America, United States. I have no proof or evidence that they watched that, but I think it could be a proof of concept, like, oh, because it's one of the few films that I'm aware of that deals with apocalypse so viscerally,
yeah,
that's from a non-Western culture, and it's fairly well respected. But I don't know. It's a good question. What are your thoughts now that you asked the question?
I think the first answer is probably the one. I think they had a story and wanted to broaden the palette and to – you're right with millennium being the likes of personal ones like in The Wild and the Innocent, and that's a cycle of abuse, and you've got – episodes like I say, Maranatha, which is obviously the Russian element of it, the Antichrist, and we've only just touched on genocide in Sense and Anti-Sense before this one as well, and you know, Beware of the Dog's kind of gone down a horror trope of pure evil. So I think you're right. I think the color palette of the show was being tested, and this was very much kind of, it doesn't make sense but then Millennium very rarely does. So the fact that you've got these potential apocalypses that the ancient tribe has had here compared to, you know, an episode like, I don't know, like coming up like the Owls and Roosters, which is where they've got two separate ones, that there is all these ideas, and the Millennium is all about the coming Millennium and how it all runs. And I think that they were just testing the water with it. And as I say, I mean, I gave this episode a 6, so that it's doing some things right, but there is these concerns, and it's not something that 1013 haven't done before. So I think that it's just something that that they were willing to write. And at least in this one, I feel that they did try to give some credence to the cultures and relate it to like the Book of Revelation and things like that. At least they're trying that way. And I think that, yeah, I think it's more to do with the palette. And, you know, it's an episode that's been written, and you know, and we'll see what happens on when you put it on screen.
Right on, right on. Well, I won't belabor this point too much, but just two other things that I wanted to hit on the representation and racial and cultural dynamics is they bring up the false face mask represents half human bodies of the power to walk between the real and the spirit world. Mm. And again, it seemed there were false face masks, but as far as I can tell, the whole rest of the stuff, there isn't any truth in the real world to that, and just trying to connect it to Frank's thing. And again, why couldn't we just make that about the Lost Tribe, and they've got their own new mask that's about that, and what a coincidence. Yeah. Okay, so two more. One other is Frank, his great-grandmother being, or I guess his grandmother. I think it's his grandmother who's Crow. I got to give Frank credit for this is for being the 90s, for not saying, hey, oh, I'm 1/8 Crow, or I'm Crow. He instead just says, my relative is. And so I got to give the writers credit for being, recognizing that point, and that was probably never brought up again in any script that I'm aware of. Kind of goes back to the discussion that Darren brought up when I was talking to him about Kaddish and if the X-Files had ever actually said if Mulder was Jewish, like his fear of fire. And so it would only ever be brought up one other time when it was tangentially related. And then
Drive, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last thing I'll bring up that really offended me, and this is where I was like, okay, I it's hard to look past it, but the scene where they mention about the two brothers, White and Red, and White is the power of reason, Red is the power of spirit, that is vile. And I know maybe it came from something real, but they should have known better to play that card. That's where I lost any goodwill for the episode.
Yeah, I did notice that one, to be fair. It was a bit, no. And I can see where they were going, as I say, but I think that you've got to have some sort of filter to be able to recognise, you know, that that's going to be a big misstep, especially with the subject matter that they're talking about, that, you know, says, don't tell the white man, and then you go and put that in your script, and it's just doesn't make any sense why you would do that.
On to fun things.
Yes.
That are not too controversial, I hope. Unfortunately, I'm going to maybe be, like, it's not necessarily negative, but I'm going to get, it's neutral, and I'll see what your thoughts are. I think maybe this sounds negative. I don't know. Here I'm rambling. I think that there's two scenes that could either be quirky or they're slightly Mary Sue-ish. One is Frank is this gambler, lays it down, and he calls and gets a perfect, and he walks off and pays back the money because he's that cool. And then walking into the morgue with the Squirrel Nut Zippers playing, and Frank knows them also. Everybody knows about, and it was just, I think both of those scenes trying to make Frank a little too cool. And then we have this episode that again is about murder and apocalypse. And we get this scene where this person is dancing goofily to this song, and Frank's like, oh, yeah, I know him. That scene was even too goofy for the X-Files. I mean, maybe Bad Blood, but I don't know where else it would have fit.
Yeah, I actually had those down in my notes as well. And I've spoken about this to a couple of other people as well in previous episodes about the change in Frank, the Bobby Darin aspect that's been brought in. He mentions that again, as if we haven't heard it in the past 4 or 5 episodes. The gambler thing was just a bit too, it was like, it was a different character. It wasn't Frank. It was somebody else. It was something Mulder would do. Like, you know, because Mulder's been known to like throw a baseball and he's just generally good at sport. It just felt forced. And you've got this kooky scene with the coroner where she's dancing away and that he comes in and then starts asking, you know, obviously that scene. And then he then flips it over to saying about Bobby Darin. Yeah, I just thought that. And also, but taking it away from Frank a little bit as well, that you get the NYPD cop also as well. He quips on a line when they're actually in the basement as well. I can't remember what exactly he says.
My helping spirit is an ant. Why? You like to ruin picnics?
Yeah, yeah. Whoa. So they are trying over the course of the last two or three episodes to lighten up. There's been obviously Brian Rodecker's another kind of light, bringing light into the show. And I think in some ways it does work. The Bobby Darin thing obviously works brilliantly in The Curse of Frank Black. You know,
yes.
I think that's fantastic. And that almost feels like it's a lead up to that. But it just feels at this moment in time when before we get there is that we're just banging on about Bobby Darin every single episode, that he likes to sing, like he likes to listen to it on the plane, that he likes to do this. And, you know, the gambler thing was kind of more of a Mulder thing for me. It just didn't feel right at all. I'm not too sure if they really worked. And you're right. It felt forced for me. I thought it wasn't. It just didn't really fit with what he was doing. And it was so quick, that gambling one, that it took me a couple of times to realise that he actually did it. So Ron Hard Eight. And that's what Morgan & Wong's company were called, wasn't it, as well? Hard Eight. So that was a little slip into a bit of meta for you as well.
Oh, good for them. Good for them. Yeah. Got to put a few Easter eggs in. Yeah,
I like a little Easter
fine.
Egg.
So. Yeah, it's totally fine. I will not begrudge them in the slightest. The next scene kind of transition, then I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about the next confrontation with the Powell and Michaels, is there's that scene where all these people are suddenly digging up the site with shovels and backhoes in the middle of the night and thinking, oh, wow, what's this going to be? It's going to be this horrible, the bad guy construction. And then Powell states that he called a university to do that. And thinking, okay, already my suspension of disbelief was really far gone. But you're trying to tell me that not only would a university be able to get that many people together and get down there overnight, have the equipment, and two, would think about treating a site like that, even in the 90s, even in corrupt New York. Mm. You should emphasize he was lying and maybe the mob did it or something interesting, but that is then talks about the Graves Protection Repatriation Act. And again, that didn't make sense either. So they're trying to bring up this real world drama about how the situation would be, how the anthropologists would behave. Well, Dr. Michaels would probably never have tenure the way she's talking about the cultures and the way she's behaving. Millennium, I think, is generally better than this, at least if you're going to ground it a little bit more. But here it's just, why make this decision? We could have created drama in a different way. And that transitions to the confrontation Powell and Michaels have immediately after that. And I know that you had some comments, so hit me.
Well, I just think that it's just so one-dimensional that we've got a character who's just there to antagonize. From minute one, all he's done is antagonize. All they're going to be building is these, I think it was apartments, wasn't it, that they were going to build, and that he's got this one-dimensional look at the history of this culture, that the building site is getting in my way. I want this done. It needs to be done. I'm going to get this sorted in whichever way I can. It's all about money. It's all about this. And it just was so atypical of a blank-slated man in a suit in New York that it just didn't feel. You're talking about the scene right before it where they're saying about the university coming to lift up all of those remains, which put you completely out of the show completely, because you've already mentioned it wouldn't happen. That would not happen. If they'd done it a different way and it was, as you say, a construction site or a separate new construction site coming in and they were building and taking it out, then fair enough. But it just didn't make any sense. And as I say, the Michaels and Powell conversation was just tropey. It was obvious. It was just too on the nose. And it was antagonizing for antagonizing's sake. And then obviously we then get the heart squeeze, which was already foreshadowed earlier on, which I thought, okay, it actually worked quite well, that bit. but you didn't need all the rigmarole that happened in the preceding 3 minutes. So, yeah, it just felt really kind of tropey for me. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, to put it mildly, yes. And then he makes a quote. He points at Joe and compatriots. Yesterday, they were on the warpath. And what happened yesterday? How were they on the warpath? I don't remember. They just were standing around, and then they went to a bar. What are we missing here? And then when the guy dies, Frank is angry at Joe. How does Frank make this connection? The script and the direction give us no implication other than a glance. Oh, yeah, remember the heart squeeze? But we have no reason or there's no motivation for Joe to do the heart squeeze. The heart squeeze was related to a different – I can't remember which nation it was, if it was Iroquois or what, and if it's even was real. It was Seneca, I think it was. I don't remember – yeah, it was Seneca. And I don't remember what nation Joe's from, and I think it was specifically certain shamans that can do it. So – we have nothing set up and there's no real motivation or showing us do it. And worst case is the guy just most likely just – it to me when I'm watching, he died of a heart attack because he's being a jerk and he's being loud. And so Frank is all of a sudden angry at this guy for doing it when there's no real motivation. It didn't make sense.
I think you hit the nail on the head there when there was no tension or anything brought up before it happened apart from him having a conversation with Michaels. If there'd been this rising tension through the episode with Powell and the standing people at the construction workers, then I think there was script issues with this episode anyway. But if there'd been a rising tension between the two, and this goes back to the whole Joel thing of giving him something to do because he's got nothing to do. If you had more of the Powell and Joe dynamic linked in with Michaels being the almost like the supporter of what Joe's wanting to do to protect that area to do whatever, then you could get your head around it. But the heart squeeze, as you say, comes out from absolutely nowhere. And the fact that we're looking at Joe just for one glance, it doesn't give you any sense of gravitas to the feeling that, you know, oh, look, the heart squeeze is real, heart squeeze is real. It was a throwaway comment in a completely different scene, in a completely different setting, which Joe wasn't even involved in. So it just doesn't match up at all. And that linked in with the fact that Powell was being so one-dimensional. And I have a particular problem with that scene, just full on. And then the heart attack, then it just does not resonate with me whatsoever.
Preach. Preach it. Let's maybe as a final topic, final major topic is to talk about horror in the third and fourth act. What are your thoughts about the episode, some of the things that worked and didn't work when it came to creating tension or aspects of horror or things like that? Because there were some attempts like the mask. There were a lot of attempts at like soft jump scares and lighting, things like that. What are your thoughts? Any particular highlights and lowlights?
Lowlights was that Dr. Michaels kept falling over. I don't know if you noticed that, but she just kept falling over. I think you're saying with the mask, there was a quite a close pull in onto the mask, which was a bit wasn't the best. I mean, we know we've mentioned that before for its connotation, but even the kind of feel to it didn't feel right. And I'm just going to go through all the negatives I think first.
Please.
And the fact that they couldn't decipher that the smoke from the manholes were fire,
yes.
I thought was a bit off. I think if you're standing on top of a manhole and you would smell smoke, you would know what smoke smells like. So I thought that was a bit off. I think some of the actual filming of it, especially in the museum and the discovery of the police officer when Dr. Michaels does fall for the third time, it was quite good. It was a soft jump. It wasn't sort of in your face jump. I thought that was okay. And I think that the actual scene with the fire, with Frank being on the actual with his arms pulled back, I thought that was okay. But and I don't know why they did this, because they didn't want to give away where they were, but you just didn't have a sense of where they actually were at that point. It didn't feel like you had a clear sense of location. It felt a bit sort of dreamy in a lot of ways, which I wouldn't know they were kind of going for. And I did think that the reveal of Frank on the other side of the fire was quite effective. I thought that was quite effective. Little scene there when he was given the snake venom. So, yeah, so I thought the snake venom scene was probably the best out of the lot of them, but there was a lot of issues that I had generally with the last act, really.
I agree. I totally missed the boat on the smoke thing. I think I was too distracted by other things, but that's a great observation there. And I also agree that the highlight is Frank's confrontation around the fire. It doesn't get a lot to work with, but he and Gray Eyes, I believe. Am I saying that correct? Yeah, Gray, both do a really good job with what they're given in that scene. And that, I think, is not just a highlight for horror, but I think the highlight of the episode for me. I'll go through speed round and just hit me if you want to flesh any of these out anymore. I thought that the original jump scare where the museum guard just kind of looks at the camera and then people walk behind him and he just keeps looking kind of at the camera was pretty comedic. I actually thought it was kind of charming. And then he later gets jump scared by a stuffed wolf in a museum that he works in. Again, maybe
just keeps forgetting that wolf's there.
Yeah. Okay. The best of this guy in his life. And so the scene where the lights go off in the lab, I felt no tension because you don't really know what's going on. There's just some movement of the camera and that she's there like touching the desk. And then they turn the lights off as soon as they leave. But why would they? Why wouldn't they just leave?
Yeah.
You can only just leave them off so you can totally get away. But instead, okay, now we got a head start. We're gonna turn them on. Try and catch us, Dr. Michaels. And then, so this doctor who believes that everything about the supernatural is real, or like most of these things, like the heart squeeze, she doesn't understand. This is a doctor, an anthropologist, doesn't understand a calendar of moon cycles. With four moon cycles. But then she goes outside and sees this perfectly CG'd half moon and goes, the time is now. And I don't mean eye roll too much, but it was so uncomfortable watching that. I had forgotten about that and just thinking, oh, okay.
I've got one of my notes to just say, Dr. Michaels, the time is now. I thought, oh, no, why have you done that? All she needs to say now is this is who we are and we're good to go. Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And then, I think, which you're probably going to link onto, is when she was working out the east and the west and it's 75 yards this way or that way. I thought that's her fully endorsing the prophecy that she, and that's the only way that we actually find Frank, that she has to follow that prophecy. Was a bit, I see what they're doing, but...
I gave him a little bit of credit, and I interpreted it a little bit different, and I could be wrong, but play devil's advocate, which I have not done during this podcast at all, is I had to rewatch that scene because I wasn't sure what she was doing at the first thing. But again, I was also pausing every few minutes to go onto Google. But I think the idea I took was, so where they were at, she hypothesized was the middle of the old longhouse, then the old hotel – was the east entrance, I guess. I can't remember which one of them.
Right. Okay,
and so, and then the other entrance is the west. So it wasn't so much that the prophecy was telling that, but that she figured out what the group was doing. That's how I read it. And I could be giving them credit or giving her credit, but that's what I took away.
It would make more sense then because he says like the doors open to the east or whatever, whichever way around it was.
Yeah.
Doors open in the west. Yeah, so I could see that. Yeah, that's something I've probably not picked up on.
I actually liked that bit. That's why I'm defending it, as I thought, oh, that's kind of a clever thing as we have this. It's a little puzzle, like where would it be and where are they going to think they're going to be at? And that would explain why they were in the hotel at the beginning. So I go, okay, that's clever.
That's the thing with Millennium that we have compared to the Mulder and Scully dynamic, that we have people on Millennium that come in for a one guest show that they don't have that struggle with just being a scientist or just being a believer in the supernatural or whatever. You don't have that dynamic, so they can be made to what they want to be. And obviously, I think Dr. Michaels is all the better for that because she's a bit of both. She's a scientist, but she's also someone that's willing to believe this stuff, and that leap is a lot easier to make than it would be for a Scully to make, and the story can be written a bit easier that way.
True. Okay. I'll go through a few more speed rounds and then I'll stop trying to bore you to death. The snake sound effect got a bit intense, especially because the snake wasn't moving its tail in any scene it was in. But that's cute. That's fine. I'm going to let it go. It just was cute. Kind of like the CG grass. I enjoyed that. I thought that was – it's and not in the – I'm not trying to patronize it. It's 97 and it's charming. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
The guy tells Frank that he is the single blade of grass. I'm thinking, well – why does it have to be him? My understanding of the single blade of grass is like the first thing that changes during the apocalypse. Why couldn't it be Daniel? Why couldn't it be anything else? I don't think the episode made that through line very clear on why that would be Frank. And then they were talking about how – and I thought it was an interesting idea, talking about the idea of inventing the apocalypse, because that comes back in later with the Millennium Group. That happens with the Frenchman even in his interpretation of Nostradamus and in Jose Chung and all the rest. So I like this. And that they – and he says they invented the ritual. But they didn't invent the ritual or necessarily invent the apocalypse because they had the stick that they found and knew this is a pre-existing thing. So
– I think that the – they may, just to play devil's advocate on that a little bit, they may be more referring to the gaps in their knowledge for the rituals that have disappeared.
Yes.
Because they were saying that a lot of them, they were trying to fill in the gaps where they weren't sure what was happening. So, yeah, I could see that being a reason for that.
That's totally fair. I just wish that kind of goes back to if they would have played the full Lost Tribe, where we don't know any of this stuff and keep a little bit more mystery and play with more of that ambiguity, it would have been nice.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought was a bit funny is when everybody's running away from the cops, A, they don't run very hard, but then Frank is nearly dead from poisoning, and then he climbs up the ladder and looks like he just is about to start his CrossFit routine. He looks completely fine.
And I was actually, and I think I've thought this every time I've watched that scene. I may have only seen this episode, I think, potentially 4 or 5 times in total. But every time I think that he's going to help her out the manhole, I know he doesn't, but it's like, hang on a second, you were close to death like literally 20 seconds ago. And you just got out there, you know, in total hero shot, you know, just standing there and you know, he's fine when, you know, the last time someone had that snake venom, they actually died. That does put me off a little bit.
I did want to bring up, so this again, I poached from Darren's review when he cites back to Frank Black and the interviews with Mayer and Randall and states, so the night before they were going to shoot the big museum sequence, they cut the budget. We had to basically rewrite Act 3 overnight, which is one of the problems with the episode. Okay, you can't do the whole giant sequence that we had planned, so you guys need to rewrite this by 9 o'clock. As you work more in television, that's something that happened. You just have to be ready for it. So, okay, this is the first time episode we weren't prepared. There was a huge thing with a wolf and things coming alive, and we couldn't do it. So I'm just wondering, hypothesizing, I'm wondering from what it describes, it sounds like this was more of a visual or set piece change and not so much necessarily the plot change too much. I wasn't sure what your thoughts about this excerpt would be.
I think that the only thing I would potentially, and this is totally me hypothesizing, so I don't know, but is that we make comments on the coyote being the trickster and that doesn't really cut on the creator and that doesn't really come back into play. So whether or not there was something that was, as I say, with the wolf, maybe that was actually a coyote potentially, and that they had something which would link in with him there. And, you know, because we do only get, 4 or 5 buffaloes, I think it is, 4 or 5 buffaloes that come in. I think I remember seeing that was maybe the script issue that I was thinking about, that it feels like there's elements with this episode overall that either needs another look at and needs another draft, or there was stuff that was cut out and it's been patched back together again, because it does feel a bit mismatchy in places, and whether or not that coyote was linking in with the wolves or and the buffaloes and things, and the end of it was going to be probably similar but with maybe a couple of additional prophecy based things within it. I think that I that's what my hypothesis would be, that it's the same story, it's the same kind of ending, but there was more issues with the wolf being a symbol for something. Because we had also as well the the owl on the wall, the mention about the owl on the wall as well. So I think that there may have been some more symbolic information that we might have missed out on.
Yeah, well, I saw the owl, I was thinking, oh, owl symbol of death, and maybe they're trying to tie it to the Millennium Group, but then I think the owls and the Millennium Group aren't really about death, so it's just an unrelated thing. But Darren did bring up, not to keep bringing it back, but read his reviews, folks. They're fabulous.
They are.
Talking about the connections that Joe is a rooster and is trying to force the end that's going to be happening in those parallels. And what are your thoughts? Do you think that the idea that this new tribe is sort of like a Millennium Group in the sense that they're from disparate places coming together and working towards this? I thought that was an interesting idea that Darren uncovered or put together.
Yeah, I think the parallels of, you know, as I say, the five tribes being split out, that they're hidden amongst them, that they will come back together for this cause, you know. And then you look at likes of Hans St. Sebastian, without going into too much detail, but you look at how the Millennium Group kind of comes around every millennium, and the evil kind of comes into the world, and, you know, it's a cyclical system. Yeah, I think that Joel's definitely trying to bring about his own apocalypse. So I can see the reasons behind that. But again, it is particularly their own kind of like thought on the Millennium Group and whatever. I can't see that. But the only thing I would have an issue with is, again, we don't have enough depth on Joe to really understand his mechanisms behind that. Now, if there was, you know, about, you know, the whole thing about the apocalypse and bringing down the white man and this guilt that, you know, that the white men have basically destroyed their culture isn't delved into. So if there was more of that, then I think it would be a much more interesting, and we'd have a lot more to say about that aspect of him bringing about his own apocalypse and him being what we would define as a rooster. So, yeah, so it's definitely something to bear in mind. I wouldn't have thought about it. That's why we have Darren. But yeah, it's definitely something to consider, and it would have been nice to delve into that a bit further in other episodes, really. If it was able to be done that way, then great.
Wonderful. Before we end, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I don't think so. I think we've covered pretty much everything. The episode itself is, as I say, it's not the best. It's not the worst episode of TV I've ever seen. I think it's watchable. And to be fair to the episode itself, throughout the whole three seasons of Millennium, this is an episode I do remember. I do remember it for a number of different reasons. Things like Frank's vision coming back and the plane of existence and things. So it's not one that you won't forget too easily, which I think is in its favour. And I just think that I thought Dr. Michaels was a good addition for this episode. She's probably one of the better guest stars that we've had so far. I would have liked to have seen more of Joe in going back again. You know, if we were to rewrite it, we definitely need more from him, really. Less of Powell, and probably less of the NYPD quips as well. But overall, you know, it's a watchable episode. It's just not one that I would consider high in the list of the 67 in Millennium's history.
Well said. Yeah, I think it's got some good set pieces. It's got some good moments. And it's got some good ideas, and the problems I talked about before, I won't rehash. And it's just a tricky thing. And if you go into watching it and are aware of that, there's still some good stuff that can be taken out of it. And again, like you said, at least it's not completely generic.
Yeah.
As much as many of the issues I do have, on one hand, I still admire them for trying things. And I think their intentions are good. And even if I think there are problems. So, you know, kudos to at least taking risks. And I guess the one thing to celebrate is reading a little bit more about the episode is that it was their first script for television and that Morgan and Wong just gave them a shot. It's their first script.
Yeah.
Heck, you know, who knows how horrible mine would be. So, and they
I can
later
guarantee you mine wouldn't be great.
And they gave us some great stuff later, and that's something to value the episode alone, is to getting them into working in television and adding their voice to Millennium, because I think they're a real important voice as the show went on. So that's one thing to celebrate. Well, Kurt, where can folks find you on the World Wide Web?
Yep, so you can find me on Twitter. My handle is at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. You can, of course, find me on this podcast as well. I've been on the past 3 or 4 weeks now, so I'll be taking a little bit of break shortly and coming back later in the season. And you can also find me on Pick Up a Podcast, which is my own personal podcast, which is on season one. I've done the first 10 episodes, and that'll be coming back later in the year.
I guess it's time. It's got to be like 4 in the morning now for Kurt, and it's time to let him free from the shackles of this ethereal plane. So until next time, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/The X-Cast. That's patreon.com/The X-Cast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.